This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, May 14th, 2012. I'm Caleb Brown. Our right to pursue exotic and often unhealthful delicacies has been under attack for some time, but should some government authority protect us from our bad decisions? Balin Linnekin is head of Keep Food Legal, a group dedicated to ensuring that we keep our rights when it comes to food. In as broad a brush as possible, what is the problem with our ability to, in an open market, go and buy the kinds of foods that we want? Half of that is probably seen, that is, these public bans on various products, certain ingredients. But there's got to be another half that is also unseen that just results in us not seeing things on shelves that we might like to see. What are the biggest problems from your perspective?
Sure. Subsidies have been, agricultural subsidies have been one of the big problems. The USDA has been, essentially, it picks winners. You know, it picks things like corn and soy that should be overproduced by subsidies. And obviously that comes at the expense of other things like, you know, leafy greens that might suffer. And so there are environmental problems that come out of that. Monocultures, which people like Michael Pollan have written about, and Mark Bittman and others in the New York Times. Although their solution is to subsidize other things rather than just to sort of wipe away the subsidy slate, which seemingly subsidies are under the gun and have largely been etched out of the farm bill as it's currently written, but it's been replaced with crop insurance, which is really just subsidies by another name.
As subsidies function, does that express itself in terms of some preferable product no longer being used in the things that we eat, such, for example, cane sugar being replaced with high-fructose corn syrup?
Yeah, that's a perfect example. You know, the U.S. government subsidizes sugar and hence high fructose corn syrup, which really, I think, results from an overabundance of corn.
I had long suspected, and I don't know if it's true or not, that part of what makes those kinds of foods easy to subsidize is that they're easy to store. Like, you don't see a lot of subsidies specifically for fresh fruits and vegetables. You don't see a lot of direct subsidies, although there may be some land use subsidies that go into meat and production of meats and things like that. But those things don't store well. Does that play a role at all?
It's an interesting point, not one I've thought about much. But I mean, there are other things that do store well that perhaps are not subsidized. I guess, you know, legumes, dried beans, things like that, stored well. But yeah, anything that you can, I guess, put in an elevator, a grain elevator, that sort of thing. It makes sense that you have anything that fits in a silo, which is the sort of, you know, I think American-originated storage space. I think that makes sense that those things are subsidized. But I don't know whether the subsidies beget the storage or the storage begets the subsidies.
Most people, I think, roll their eyes when they hear about various restrictions on like salt in foods or prohibitions on placing certain items on tables in restaurants. But nonetheless, these types of regulations have currency. They're able to get through. They get passed. And maybe it's a function of the kind of people I hang out with, but I don't sense that there's a lot of public support for those ideas, and yet there they are.
Well, there's the public health community, which has, you know, at the sort of administrative law level, I think wields increasing power in this country. In places like New York City, for example, the health department, I can't think of a week in the last 5 years, and I may be overstating the case slightly, but where I haven't heard about some new proposed regulation, which often, as you point out, you know, because of low public support, is sort of pulled back at the last minute, or the New York City Public Health Department will pretend that, in fact, they never had this plan to restrict whatever food it is that they, you know, were considering restricting. It probably is a function of your friends that you don't find a lot of public support. I think there are people, I don't think it's perhaps as wide as the public health community would argue it is, but there certainly is a segment of society that that thinks that food should be restricted. I just think that it's a vocal minority as opposed to certainly the mainstream.
You've talked and written a lot about food trucks as well. And of course, getting to live in D.C. means that we have access to a lot of food trucks. It's a low-cost entrepreneurial project for a lot of people who then go on to found brick and mortar restaurants. And yet there is this opposition. I think it's been muted recently in D.C., but in a lot of cities where brick and mortar shops are getting regulations passed that say, well, you can't locate your truck within 300 feet of me. And my argument has always been, well, why don't you ban pizza delivery? Because that's a very similar project where I bring you food. I bring food to where you are rather than you having to come into my shop. Is that sort of where do we stand in general on that type of regulation in the United States, and which side is winning?
Well, the pizza delivery angle is a very good one. It's I have an op-ed which I expect will probably be published this week on the regulatory scene in D.C., and I do make the pizza delivery analogy. I swear I wrote the op-ed before hearing your example. But yeah, it's a UPS delivery van, same idea. They double park. You know, they actually are sort of creating road blocks and hazards, whereas the food trucks, you know, pay a parking meter and sit there. So the situation might be a little more tenuous in D.C. than you paint it. There is a potential crackdown on where trucks can park. The creation of zones, for example, it's not a sure thing, but certainly it's something that's worth fighting back against. As far as the regulations around the country, I was just in Chicago recently for a food truck conference, and the regulations there state that, A, you can't cook on a truck, which presents a clear public health hazard if you have to, you know, cook your food in the morning and then bring it out and serve it to people for, say, 6 hours. And the other particularly onerous part of the regulations there is that there are zones that you just cannot park in. And if you look at a map, I think the Institute for Justice has a map of the city with sort of concentric circles around, and it's like a piece of Swiss cheese where it's only holes. And it's unfortunate. There are other efforts. There is some ongoing litigation in California around restrictions there that, based on the state constitution, are pretty clearly unconstitutional. And some fights. I saw Atlanta today, actually. The police began enforcing an outdated regulation, a new regulation just passed that I think supersedes the enforcement. But so Atlanta was, as recently as yesterday, closing down a truck lot by saying that the trucks didn't have a permit because every time they move, they need a new permit for wherever it is they have to park. So they have to go to the, you know, the regulatory agency every day to get a permit, which is an impossibility, I think.
Part of what has made food trucks so viable is social media. That is, they develop a fan base. They locate wherever they need to, wherever they sense they're going to do good business. And in that sense, I guess technology is really challenging in some ways, the brick and mortar places that do lunch for the most part.
Yeah, absolutely. The sort of flourishing of social media as a tool for bringing us new ways of enjoying food is actually a topic that I'm teaching an undergraduate course at American University in the fall, which is booked already, which I'm proud of. It's called Food Ways 2.0, and in it I look at the ways that social media has been used to establish these sort of entirely new ways of eating in America. And that includes food trucks, but it also includes underground restaurants, pop-up restaurants, things that probably could not exist without, at least at this time, without social media.
Obviously, underground restaurants pose a regulatory problem for people who would like to decide what how food is prepared and things like that. And you know, there are some on their face not bad arguments for why some agency ought to be charged with that task. The argument I hear often is, well, look, you're not allowed to go into a kitchen. As a customer, you don't go into a kitchen. Somebody should go into that kitchen and make sure that solvents aren't being stored above deep fryers, that sort
right.
of thing. What do you think of that idea? That is this idea of a central agency, a government agency that's charged with making those kinds of determinations?
Well, I don't think it has to be a government agency. I mean, I think that you know, we have places like Underwriters Laboratories and publications like Consumer Reports that do a pretty whiz-bang job of telling us, you know, which electronics and which cars and which blenders, and I guess that's an electronic, but, you know, what's safe, what's good, what's highly rated. And I think that that sort of agency at the, private agency at the local level, a certifying body could certainly take that role. Now, is the city health inspection sort of the worst thing in the world? No, it's not. I think that some sort of inspection of restaurants and perhaps of home kitchens is not outside of the scope of government's powers. But I do think that just because regulation, must exist or has to exist in a certain area doesn't mean that it should be overly strict. It should be sort of the least restrictive means.
Malin Lineken is head of Keep Food Legal. You can learn more about regulation of food at our website, cato.org.